Chapter 7. Slowly, Yellowhammer Ranch starts to change. It begins with the installment of cameras throughout the property, along with several traps and hidden automated weapons. Once the perimeter feels secure, I focus on the inside of the house. I seal up the windows to the office, fortifying the walls, turning it into a safe room. I replace the normal door with a blast door that will only open when my fingerprint is scanned, and hide that behind a quilt I pull off one of the extra beds and hang on the wall. If anyone was to search the house, they'd likely have no idea there was a room in the back unless they really started calculating measurements. If I was ever attacked, the room would protect me, at least for a little while. Long enough for me to reload my weapons and perform a few last-second computer operations. The only weak spot when I'm done with my renovations is the floor. That's where I plant the small remote-activated explosive device I put together from parts purchased on the darker sections of the internet. The bomb is an emergency failsafe, though it's perhaps odd to think of it in those terms. It's not protection for me, really, but for the guard. If something were to happen, if it looked like I'd lost the ranch, just a few clicks in a program and I could ensure that all my work and information went up in flames. I'd rather it be destroyed than fall into Moog hands. Even though I know better than to try to reunite the other Lorik, I do my best to serve as their guardian. I continue to delete any news stories that sound even the least bit connected to them. Saving copies for myself so that I can in some way keep a sense of where some of the guard might be. For the most part, I don't find much. I hope that means that the guard are settled safely in hiding, establishing new identities, getting stronger. Although I'm diligent, I can't help but think that I'm missing things. I'm only one person, and this planet is so much bigger than Lorien. Still, I do my best. The users of Aliens Anonymous are sometimes helpful, my team of informants growing. They've pointed me to a few events or news pieces that look as though Moogs may be involved. It's difficult to weed through them all, though. Many of the users who flock to the website are lunatics or trolls, a term I've learned and often witnessed in action since starting Aliens Anonymous. But there are some who are true believers, who give me useful information and follow my suggestions when I say that they should investigate their theories further and report back to me. I keep myself at a distance from them, putting their data to use, but trying not to dwell on the particulars of their lives too much. They work with me, but I am alone. A few of them lose interest, one or two disappear completely. I tell myself that they, too, have just grown bored. I track my enemy's movements as well, trying to think like a Mogadorian. I learn about the sighting of weird spacecrafts in West Virginia, the description similar to some of the Mogadorian ships I've seen, and of tattooed gangs seen in various parts of the world. It has been more difficult to suss out information about their involvement with the U.S. government than I had expected. The FBI and other agencies have firewalls unlike anything I've ever seen, much too advanced for this planet. It's my assumption that along with whatever promises the Moogs are making to the United States, they're also offering them technology. It reminds me of the grid on Lorien, but even more advanced. Impenetrable. I refrain from pushing too much, for fear that this technology could track me in ways I never imagined. What I need is an in, like when the grid failed on Lorien and I was able to get my own hardware attached to the system. I don't know how I'm going to get that, though, because the last thing I want to do is go storming some Moog base again. The ship is never far from my mind. I draw out blueprints and write down everything I can remember about the computer systems and construction of ships from my time at the LDA. I try to estimate what state it might be in after the long trek from Lorien to Earth. I doubt its power crystals could handle another intergalactic flight, And so I try to figure out how I might adapt the ship's power core to run on the fuel systems available on this planet. My research delves further into engineering than my actual training ever took me at the LDA, and is mostly hypothetical. Still, I start to build a few preliminary adapters and secondary power sources. I want to be prepared. I keep tabs on Dulcie as much as I can. It seems like my fears have been realized. The sheriff and officers I left behind are found dead, and the blame gets put on drug cartels moving through the area. Soon after that, the town slowly dissipates and dries up. A private investor buys most of the land. I track the funds back to a few dummy accounts. It's obvious that the Moogs or the FBI are responsible. I manage to hack into a satellite feed that gives me a visual of the base during the day, after a decryption program is run over the images. But it's neither detailed nor very helpful. Still, I keep the feed running on one of my many monitors at all times. If they move my ship, I want to know about it. I catch a few Moog transporters moving on video. I save these clips and add them to my growing info bomb, a digital packet of information I've gathered about the Moogs, about their history on Lorien, and even my own writing about what happened to my home planet and my experience in Dulcie. Earth is not ready for this information. The Guard are not ready for this to be revealed. But one day soon, they will be. Time passes. I gather intel. I like to think I'm helping, but I'm not sure. 2 years blink by, and I decide to leave Yellowhammer Ranch. I get too comfortable in the wooden farmhouse, too familiar with the rolling hills. The place suddenly starts to feel claustrophobic. I don't abandon it completely. It could still come in handy. But I gather most of my equipment and all of my data and leave for a new secluded location in the Oregon woods. It's there that I finally get a glimpse into Agent Purdy's personal files, thanks to his incompetent assistant, who likes to work on unprotected wireless networks and coffee shops. I manage to get into Purdy's email account and read through a few messages detailing an operation codenamed MoogPro. It's mentioned in passing, never defined, but I understand that it has something to do with Moog infiltration of the government. I take some screen grabs and save a few files, but after a couple of minutes in his email account, my computer completely freaks out. It crashes, not in a way I've ever seen before. I fear I've been discovered. I leave Oregon minutes later, never looking back. I move often after that, setting up safe houses around the country. The deeper I dig, the less safe I feel staying in one place for too long. But moving has its downsides. I'm in the midst of relocating when a blog post slips through the cracks. 9. Now 8. Are the rest of you out there? By the time I see it and wipe it away, it's too late. I trace the poster's IP address to a physical address in London. After that, it only takes a few minutes to discover that a 12-year-old girl was found murdered there shortly after the post went up. One of the Guard, no doubt. If her math was correct, that means she was number 2. If she's dead, that means so is 1, and likely their Sapons. Our numbers continue to decrease. And our allies keep disappearing. I keep track of Malcolm Good, but not long after I met with him, he disappears, leaving his truck and glasses behind in a grocery store parking lot in Paradise. I go back to the message board I used to find him in the first place and try to track down the others he corresponded with. Their years-old communications leads me to other dead ends, or more often, missing persons. The authorities don't seem to have any leads on where Malcolm might be. They posit that he might have even left on his own, but I have no doubt that the Mogadorians or the FBI tracked him down. When I read this news, Something inside my gut twists, and all I can see is the face of the little boy standing outside of Malcolm's office, staring up at me. At least the rest of the goods seem to be safe. I shudder to think that the Moogs might be using them to try to get information out of Malcolm. I consider going back to Paradise and taking them to one of my safe houses. But would they go? If not, would I take them against their will? Should I even risk exposing myself at all by going back to Ohio? No, that's not my place or role in all this. I coordinate from behind the scenes. I warned Malcolm they would find him. I did everything I could. He should have left. When I'm not moving or researching, I gather weapons, ammunition, medical supplies, cash, any and all resources that might come in handy. I plant caches of them in my safe houses, which I no longer view as my own, but as places that the guard may one day use. When they're ready. When they're strong. One day soon they'll make a move, and I'll be watching, waiting to finally expose the Mogadorians on Earth and help the last of my people destroy them. Chapter 8. By the time the Moogs make their big play in Paradise, years have passed and I've settled into a new base, an old orchard and pecan processing plant in Georgia. It's so obvious to me when I read the reports, both public and those I find in the Paradise Police Department's files, that this is a Moog incident. Something big. The Moogs wouldn't just attack a high school without a reason. Especially not one that happened to be located in the small town where Malcolm Good lived. I think back to what Malcolm had told me about one of the Sapans saying he'd return to Paradise when his guard was of age. When I find the YouTube clip of a boy who goes by the name of John Smith, basically flying out of a burning house, my assumptions are confirmed. At least one of the guard faced off against the Moogs in Ohio. I write up a big story on Aliens Anonymous, positing that the incident at Paradise High School is somehow related to alien activity. I don't mention the Moogs or Lorik by name. The trick to running this blog is playing dumb and never really showing off what I know. I'm baiting the hook, trying to find someone who has more information. The website has grown to have a dedicated user base over the years, and typically, it doesn't take too long for someone to bite. I don't get the full story until a user named JollyRoger182 contacts me through the site. He tells me what happened at the high school and about the evil ETs that he and some of his friends fought off. Within no time, I deduce that his real name is Mark James, based on the information he gives out. A love of football, his ex-girlfriend's name, which I cross-reference against information I find in the Paradise Police Department's files on the burning down of the James's residence. He thinks he's being really sly, but his internet activity is an open book to me until I teach him how to block his IP address and send encrypted messages. It's not until I discover that he's met number 4 and number 6 that I get really interested. Not only am I finally messaging with someone who has had direct contact with some of my people, but from Mark's stories, it sounds as though the guard are finally coming together. I can't help but feel a rush of adrenaline, knowing that after all these years, the work and planning I've been doing might finally be useful, that we can expose the Moogs and the FBI soon. At first, Mark is just another informant. I dumb down my speech and feign excitement when he first brings up the words Moog and Lorik, as if I've never heard them before. He seems harmless enough, and I assume his interest will eventually die down, until he mentions that his ex-girlfriend, Sarah Hart, is dating number 4. When I read this, I almost can't believe my eyes. Here's my possible direct link to the guard. I try to get any information that I can about 4's whereabouts, but it seems that neither Mark nor Sarah know where he and 6 went when they left Paradise. It feels like something big is about to happen. The Guard and Moogs are coming out into the open. War is finally upon us. There's something else, too. The FBI start following Mark and Sarah around. An agent gives Mark a contact number, which he then passes on to me. I call it, using a satellite phone and a voice changer just to ensure my anonymity. I get someone I recognize on the other end of the line. Special Agent Purdy. My blood starts to boil. I wish I could reach through the phone and smash in his nose again. Instead, I hang up and destroy the phone. Purdy seemed to have a fair amount of authority in Dulce, and I don't want to risk him tracking me down using methods that I don't know about. I can't be too careful. And then, everything escalates very quickly. Sarah disappears. Mark freaks out. His concern and passion are unbridled, worn on his sleeve. He tries to find her any way he can, his desperation to uncover the truth about what's been going on rivaling even my own. I find myself talking to him more and more, with far more frequency than with my other contacts. Maybe it's because this has become personal for him, too. I admire his passion. During his investigations, he discovers print copies of a now-defunct newsletter called They Walk Among Us, a publication I'd been feeding information and funds to for years, working to expose the Moogs little by little. He suggests we change the website name to They Walk Among Us to attract the newsletter's readers. I agree. It's a good idea. Unfortunately, Mark's not always the smartest kid. His overzealousness is problematic. He pulls a stunt where he sneaks into the police department looking for clues and sees a Moog for himself, the FBI and Moog partnership in action. Mark likely should have ended up in their custody or dead. But with some kind of luck, he managed to escape. With Purdy's laptop. Mark messages me after he swipes it. Mark, they've got Sarah and Dulce at that secret base from TWAU. Mark, I'm going after her. I gotta. I'm leaving Paradise right now. We're gonna bust this thing wide open. I almost laugh. Of course that's where she is. I start to type back to him, warning him that Dulce is a no-go, that it's too dangerous. But as I'm looking at my satellite feed from the base, I notice something strange. There's a very subtle glitch in the bottom corner of the screen. I keep watching and realize that I've been looking at a loop of the same 20 seconds of footage over and over again from the satellite feed. Shit! I curse myself. I don't appear to have been hacked, but there's no telling how long I've had the fake feed running on my monitor. Why? Was this just an ordinary precaution? Or is there something more to it? It takes me a few minutes to find a way around the repeating video, and finally the current state of Dulce comes into view. There's smoke rising from the base, and it looks like several buildings have collapsed. Something has gone down very, very recently in Dulce, and I need to know what. An idea forms in my head. Mark James is going to Dulce. It's not like I'll be able to talk him out of it. Not when Sarah is involved. I can help him along the way, give him supplies, guide him. In return, he'll tell me what the base is like now, what happened there. Besides, if he gets taken into custody, he'll need someone on the outside to try and save him. And so I respond, me. Be careful. The place is probably crawling with Moogs and FBI agents. Don't do anything stupid. It only takes a few seconds for him to respond. Mark, wouldn't dream of it. It takes all of a few hours for Mark to get locked out of Purdy's computer, and I curse myself for not immediately insisting that he send the damn thing straight to me. It's probably the same sort of firewall that fried one of my computers in Oregon. We're possibly kicked out of the machine for good, or at least until I can figure my way around Moog securities. So my focus turns to make sure Mark gets to the Dulcie base alive so he can tell me what the hell has happened there. To ensure that this happens, I put together a little care package and meet him in person at a closed-down gas station on the Colorado-New Mexico border. I manage to get there only a few minutes before he does, after driving through the night on my bike, going much, much faster than is either legal or safe. He wouldn't be talked into waiting a few days, insisting on going straight to Dulcie. Not that I blame him. It doesn't seem like all that long ago that I was in his position. I give him a box packed with supplies, even one of Raylan's concussion EMP grenades that I've been carrying around with me from base to base all these years, and have him sign a fake confirmation slip. I play the part of the courier. He doesn't think twice about the fact that I can't be guard once he sees me. I'd been ready to play dumb, but I guess after referring to me as dude about 100 times over the last few weeks, he never really gave any thought to the fact that his online partner might be female. I don't correct him. If for some reason he ends up detained at Dulcie and I can't get him out, it'll be in my best interest if he can't identify me. He looks different in person than in the photos I tracked down of him online. Strung out with dark circles under his eyes. The events of Paradise and Sarah's disappearance weigh on his face. I find myself oddly concerned about him. "You should get off the road and get some sleep," I say. "You look like shit." I don't hang around to converse. Instead, I check into a hotel on the Colorado side of the border and wait for him to report back. Part of me feels like I should have given him more warning, but I tell myself again that he'll be fine. This isn't like Zophie when I left her alone, thinking that Janus could still be alive. Mark is well aware of the dangers he's facing. The sun is rising when I finally get a message from him. I'd just about given up hope that he was still a free man. "Mark. Dulcie's a bust. FBI is abandoning it. Sarah's gone. I think John and the others got her out." Me. "You got in and out and no one saw you? I'm impressed." Mark. "Nah. Ran into Agent Walker from Paradise. She let me go. I think she's turned against the Moogs." If the Dulcie base is being abandoned, now is the time for me to claim my ship, assuming they didn't move it while the video loop was in place. The thought fills me with warmth, my blood pumping through my veins. Plus, if the FBI agents at the base have turned on the Moogs, it means at least some of the humans are beginning to see that working alongside those monsters is a death sentence for the human race. They're not just blindly following them. "Maybe there's hope for this species after all," I think. And in doing so, I realize, perhaps for the first time, what respect I have for Mark. Someone who has been fighting for his friends and his planet this whole time, trying to save his people from whatever horrible endgame the Moogs are trying to enact. And here I've been, withholding information from him, using him for my own means, as a pawn. When it comes down to it, I'm no better than one of the elders. Maybe I can make up for that. I wonder what he's going to do now that Sarah's not where he thought she would be. Me. "Where are you going now?" Mark. "No damn clue. Can't go home. Bad FBI are still looking for me." Perhaps it's the rush of adrenaline pumping through me, or that lingering pang of guilt for not being completely honest with him. For whatever reason, I feel like I owe it to Mark to help him. I can guide Mark from afar. I message him back, instructing him to drive toward Alabama. I know just the place he can hide out for a while and continue his work. Yellowhammer Ranch. Only it's been a while since I've been on the property, so I tell him to take his time, that I'll have a space set up for him just as soon as I get a few personal things in order. The last thing I need is Mark James wandering onto the grounds of Yellowhammer, only to get blown up by a defensive trap I forgot to defuse. Chapter 9. I head for Dulce, for my ship. I pass half a dozen black SUVs, all speeding through the desert about 5 miles away from the perimeter of Dulce Base. I consider this fortuitous timing. If these are the FBI agents Mark mentioned, then they have indeed abandoned the place. Still, I have my reservations about this operation. It's a bright morning for one thing, meaning I can't rely on the cover of night, and the memory of what happened the last time I tried to infiltrate this base is fresh in my mind. But I won't get another opportunity like this. Who knows how long it will be before the Moogs or the rest of the FBI realize that no one at this base is responding. Besides, this time, I've come prepared. I pause at a section of the fence surrounding the base that's been destroyed and take out some of the gear from my backpack. Thermal imaging binoculars that can sense heat signatures through 6 inches of steel. Nothing pops up on them. At least nothing that reads as a human or Moog. There are a few fires and lights I can make out, but nothing that suggests anyone is patrolling the base. Regardless, I proceed with caution and park my bike near a pit that's been created by the roof of the first underground floor of the base, collapsing in on itself. I take a look around and note some burned-out Humvees and a knocked-down watchtower. Mark thinks the guard broke Sarah out, and if that's the truth, they certainly have grown strong. I hop down into the base and pull out a small electronic tablet of my own design, part computer and part tracker, a device that can hone in on the frequencies of a Lorik ship when within a certain range. I wasn't sure it would work until now, but it pings, telling me that yes, Janus's ship is still down here somewhere, waiting for me. I breathe a sigh of relief. The agents must have left the place in a hurry, because every office I pass is disheveled, files strewn about. Several big computer terminals look damaged, as if in leaving, the FBI didn't want anyone else getting its information. That's a concern I can understand. I'll have to come back up and see what data I can harvest once I've found what I've actually come for. I make my way down several floors. Eventually, I get to a hallway that's dark, lights all knocked out. It's the only place I've been in the base where every door is shut. I make my way through the corridor slowly, on the tips of my toes, trying hard not to make a sound. I pass a door with a slit of a window in it, which I peer through carefully. A man stares back at me. He shouts, slamming his fists against the door. He's got on a white button-down shirt spotted with blood. Suddenly, there's banging from all the doors in the hallway, and I realize that I must have wandered into some sort of brig or detention area. The sound is deafening, echoing off the hard surfaces of the corridor and destroying all hopes of a stealthy exploration through the remainder of the base. And so, I start to run. I pass a few laboratories and office spaces before finally flinging open a door that leads to it in all its silvery, beaten-up glory. The ship. The vessel is big, the size of a house, but with the ability to glide and turn effortlessly through the air. The gleaming metal of its hull shines, even after all these years, made of a material native to Lorien. Its curves are all perfectly rounded, sleek and aerodynamic. It takes my breath away. There are all kinds of wires connected to the portion of the hull housing the crystals that supply power to the ship. I find a computer terminal on the opposite side of the room and tap on it, bringing the station to life. Now that I'm here, it's easy to break through their passwords. I try to find some sort of journal or report system, downloading everything I can to my own tablet along the way. From what I can tell, the researchers here have been trying to figure out how to duplicate the crystal's energy to incorporate it into their own war machines. Their records show that they've managed to charge the spent crystals at least a little bit, but that's all, and the charge only lasts for a short period of time. I doubt I could get out of Earth's atmosphere on it. That's fine for now. At the moment, I just want to get it out of here. With a little more searching, I find controls that appear to operate some sort of dock. I flip them on, and 60 feet above me the ceiling begins to part. Sand, dirt, and debris fall in. I narrowly avoid a pile of bricks in what looks like a Humvee tire that come crashing down. For a second, I pause, shaking my head, thinking of how terrible it would be for me to die just as I've finally found this ship that I've been after for so long. The hangar doors above me open fully. I take a few steps toward my prize and pause. I can still hear the whirring noise I'd thought was the door mechanism, getting louder. It's then that I see the edge of the Mogadorian ship just over the lip of the hangar. In seconds, half a dozen pale, sneering faces are looking down at me, all pointing weapons in my direction. I duck behind the computer station just as blaster fire starts to fill the air. Sparks rain down on me, burning my skin as the terminal is destroyed. I curse under my breath. Hopefully these controls shorting out don't overload the wires attached to the ship. I'm too much of a target where I am. The quickest way to stay alive would be to try and cross the room and head back inside the base. At least there I'd have plenty of options for cover. But I have to assume that the Moogs are already starting to filter down through the hallways and stairwells of the facility, and without any idea of how many alien bastards have just landed on the ground level, the base could quickly turn into a death trap. Somewhere I could get boxed in too easily. Besides, now that I've found this ship, I don't intend to let it out of my sight. So I reach into my backpack and pull out one of the many toys I've acquired and learned to use since the last time I came face to face with a Mogadorian. A powerful, compact submachine gun. Earth weapons might be crude and inefficient, but practicing out in the barns and woods around my many safe houses, I've witnessed exactly how devastating they can be. If I can make it inside the ship and power it up, I may be able to get out of here alive. If not, well, that's not really an option. I think of Janus and Zophie, and how when I first arrived on this planet, I thought for sure that the three of us would one day be riding in this ship together. Now, the best I can do is reclaim it for them. Falorian. I brace myself as much as I can against the floor, peek over the top of the sparking computer terminal, and fire away. A few of the Mogadorians who are descending a zigzag metal staircase from the surface are ripped apart, turning into wafts of dust that filter down into the hangar. The others take quick cover, and I use this moment of surprise to make a break for it, tossing my bag ahead of me and basically throwing myself under the ship in the center of the room, using it for cover. Blaster fire blackens the cement floor, barely missing me. But I make it somehow. I'm able to access a manual override switch to the boarding hatch. A metal ramp rolls out from the back of the craft. One of the Moogs from above jumps down, sliding over the ship and onto the ground. There's a snap when he lands, and when he stands, one of his arms hangs limply at his side. That doesn't stop him from staggering forward, firing at me. Several of his fellow troops follow his lead, and I barely manage to climb onto the ramp, firing blindly behind me the entire time. I run, trying to avoid their blasters, but a few shots hit my backpack. I've reinforced the thing with Kevlar, mostly to protect my laptop and gadgets inside, but it stops the shots from burning through my body. Still, the force sends me sprawling onto the ramp. I roll over and return fire, scooting as fast as I can toward a touchscreen panel on the wall just inside the ship. I dust one of the Moogs following me as I manage to tap on the screen and get the ramp to start closing in just a couple of seconds. The few years of training I had at the Lorian Defense Academy all coming back to me in a rush. The other Moog on the ramp stumbles forward as it folds up. He gets thrown past me deeper into the ship. The interior of the vessel can be programmed with all sorts of holographic partitions and walls, but right now it's just one big empty room, There's no place for him to hide, and he's a pile of ash before he ever manages to pick himself up off the ground. I run to the front cabin, my hands fly over buttons and screens. In front of me, Amok has climbed onto the nose of the ship and is hammering away at the tinted cockpit window with the butt of his blaster. He'll have a hell of a time trying to break through the reinforced glass. I try not to pay any attention to him. Come on, come on, come on, I chant to myself as the instruments start to flicker, going online. And then they come to life, as if goaded on by my will. The crystals still have some life in them. I can feel the engines powering up, the reassuring hum and slight vibration that permeate the entire ship. I engage auto-launch protocols, which should at least get me up into the sky, where I can chart a course or take over the controls myself. The Moog on the windshield struggles to find his balance as the ship starts to shake and lift off the ground. He howls as he falls backwards, tumbling to the cement below. It's working, I think. I'm getting out of here. My eyes widen as I get to the ground level. Sitting in front of me is the small Mogadorian ship I'd spotted from below, but also a large one that must be used to move troops around the planet. Lots of troops. Moogs mill about around it, all their eyes on my silver craft. They freeze for only an instant before they start to fire. What looks like a cannon on the bigger ship turns towards me. Who knows what kind of firepower a vessel like that might have? I flit through the on-screen menus in front of me until I find what appears to be a log of the ship's weaponry. Most vessels on Lorien were unarmed, but I guess the Elders equipped this one with every possible armament it could carry. Weapons I've never even heard of before. I wonder again how far their planning went, and how long they knew that the Moogs were coming for us. I don't have long to reflect, though, because I've still got guns trained on me. And so I touch an icon that appears to be some sort of grenade projectile and target the enemy ship. A small sphere of energy shoots from just below the cockpit. It sticks to the side of the rising Mogadorian vessel. Nothing happens. Shit. I can see the Moog cannon powering up, energy gathering around it. I tap on the weapons screen again. Don't tell me you're a dud, you son of a... The sphere explodes in a wave of energy that knocks back my own ship. The autopilot levels me off, and then I take over the controls and hit the accelerator, flying high into the sky, far, far above New Mexico, shouting at the top of my lungs as I dart through the air. I check my radar, but there's no one following me. I swing the vessel around, surveying the damage from hundreds of feet above in the clear sky. The Moog ships don't exist anymore. There's nothing left to follow me. Only blazing hunks of twisted metal. Energy courses through me, filling my head with fuzzy warmth. We did it, I say, before I realize the words are even coming out of my mouth. We have the ship. I'm not sure who I'm talking to, who the we is, if I'm addressing Zophie or the other guards spread across the planet, or even Mark, my unwitting partner in this dulcy operation. On the way back, I stop over at Yellowhammer Ranch, setting the ship down in the backyard by the dilapidated barn. The place looks untouched since the last time I saw it, if not a bit overgrown. I find one of the keys hidden in a sliding panel on the side of the house and go inside, pulling off some of the drop cloths that are still on the furniture. I reprogram the door to the secret office to open to Mark's fingerprint, which I have on file, thanks to the fingerprint ID system in the laptop I sent him charging into Dulcie with. Inside the office, I take stock of the weapons organized on shelves against one wall, and then boot up the security system, checking to make sure all my cameras are still in operation. A few electronic tripwires and traps are still live around the ranch, but I disable them so that Mark isn't met with an automated weapon upon his arrival. I can always teach him to reset them later, when he's settled in. I keep the bomb beneath the office primed, ready to be set off in the event that the safe house falls into enemy hands, just in case. This will make a nice home for Mark, at least for the time being, until I can figure out what to do with him, or until he finally manages to get in contact with Sarah and the rest of the guard. I wonder if I should just wait here for him, to reveal myself to him in person. I have the ship, after all. Things are going well. But I recognize this feeling, the thought that things are finally going my way and that everything's falling into place. Every time I've allowed myself to be comforted by such hope, things have gone terribly wrong. People have died. My world shattered, needing to be rebuilt. I just need a little more time to patch up the ship and figure out my next move. And he needs to recoup too. I'm not ready to lead my protege into battle. Not yet. In the morning, I'll take the motorbike stored in the old barn into town and bring back a few fresh supplies for Mark. Food, water, extra ammunition. A small gesture of thanks for being my first set of eyes on Dulcie Base. For now, though, I scrawl a note in thick black marker on the back of a folder and set it beside a shotgun for him to find later. I hope you're ready for war. G. Chapter 10. The ship barely makes it back to my Orchard base in Georgia. I fly beneath radar and try to stay in cloud cover as much as possible along the way. By this point, the acceleration is hardly faster than that of a car or motorcycle. The battery is almost dead. The crystals are fading. I manage to get the ship parked in the big old pecan processing plant in the back. I guess it's technically now a hangar. Most of my energy and resources are immediately focused on figuring out how to get and keep the ship up and running for good. I start installing various adapters and fuel lines I've created over the years, hoping that all my work hasn't been for nothing. I go over the research I've swiped from the Dulcie computers to see what the scientists have been doing to try and repower the drives. I manage to connect the crystal housings to an electric output, just like they'd done in Dulcie. If nothing else, that should buy me a few days' worth of power. The only reason the ship doesn't have my full attention is because one of my sensors picks up some strange activity on Mark James's old burner cell phone. I've been monitoring his communications since I got involved with him on the website, just to keep tabs on him. It's something I've done with everyone I've worked with from the blog, though Mark is definitely the person I've gotten closest to. It looks as though someone has sent him messages from Guard, telling him to meet up with them. Communications that definitely didn't come from me. Somewhere, Mark slipped up. The enemy has found him. I try to warn Mark, but I'm too late. Fortunately, he manages to escape from a team of FBI agents still loyal to the Moogs, but at the cost of his gear, his truck, and from what I can tell, a bit of his mental stability. And he was shot in his arm as he fled the ambush, though he swears it's just a flesh wound. He's stressed out, lost, and feeling hopeless. When I talk to him on the chat client I built for They Walk Among Us, he sounds depressed. I'm suddenly worried that he might give up, even after all he's been through. And I can't have that. Not now that I've gotten so used to him always being in touch. I realize that he's the only person I talk to on a regular basis. He's the closest thing I've had to a friend since Sophie died. So I do my best to try and remedy these things with a new vehicle and directions to Yellowhammer Ranch. That all seems to perk him up a bit. At Yellowhammer, Mark connects Purdy's stolen laptop to some computer equipment I left behind, allowing me to copy the entire contents of its hard drive to cloud storage. I isolate Purdy's files and begin a full-fledged attack on their firewalls and security, Cut off from the rest of the Mogadorian and FBI networks, I have no fear of being caught as I break into every hidden corner of his hard drive. What I discover is a wealth of information about MogPro and the specifics of the Mogadorian involvement with the U.S. government. As I work, Mark finally manages to get in contact with Sarah. As Mark thought, she'd been traveling with the guard. She's an invaluable source of information and the link to my people here on Earth that I've been searching for. Things seem to be going smoothly, which is why I shouldn't be surprised when everything falls apart. I'm installing a new power line in the ship that will use the primitive fuel sources on this planet when I get a message from Mark saying that he screwed up and thinks the Moogs might have a lead on Yellowhammer. He asks if he should abandon it completely or go back for his notes and files. I tell him it's his call. He heads back to the ranch with Sarah to pack up. I'm left to wait for word from him. I pull up the cameras at Yellowhammer just in time to see him and Sarah rush inside and start packing. Then, everything goes black. I can't reestablish a connection. All I've got are monitors full of static. My heart falls into my stomach. Every second that passes makes me more impatient, more worried that I should have told him to leave everything and run from Alabama. As I wait, I pull up a program on one of my monitors, the controls to the bomb planted underneath Yellowhammer Ranch. At what point should I assume the worst and detonate the failsafe, keeping the Mogadorians from getting any of Mark's notes? What if I set off the bomb too early and end up killing Mark and Sarah in the process? In that moment, alone in my safe house, all I want in the universe is to see Mark's name appear on my cell phone. He's been my eyes and ears for the past few months. We've been in constant contact. I can't lose him. Nor can I believe that Jolly Roger 182, the alien's anonymous user, who referred to Moogs as janky-looking assholes from another planet in his first message to guard, has become a valuable asset, not only to the Lorik cause, but to me personally. The clock ticks. I stare at the button that will destroy Yellowhammer. I wonder if I have it in me to press it after all this time. Would I risk sacrificing Mark and Sarah to keep information from falling into Moog hands? Relief bursts through my skull when my phone dings. It's a text from Mark saying they were attacked but are all right. I call him back on one of my burners that has a voice modulator built in. My voice comes out electronic, distorted on his end of the line. "How far are you and Sarah from the house?" I ask when he answers. "I don't know. Maybe a mile? I can still see it and..." I click the button. There's static on the line as Mark's microphone picks up the sound of Yellowhammer Ranch exploding. That should take care of any Moogs remaining on the property and thoroughly wipe our tracks, I say. Mark doesn't sound too thrilled about the fact that he'd been sitting on top of a bomb all this time, but I'm too focused on typing to pay much attention to his concern. Instead, I tap into his truck's built-in GPS and input the coordinates to the Georgia safe house. It's time to move forward in the fight against the Moogs, to join my fellow Lorik. The first step is to finally reveal myself to Mark and Sarah. When Mark and Sarah show up, they look stunned, likely due to a combination of seeing me, the ship, and the automated weapons that target them when they trip my security system. The incredulous silence doesn't last, though, as they begin to ask a million questions. I assess the situation and prioritize. Mark is feverish, and the bullet wound in his arm is completely infected. The first thing I do is give him a shot of the antibiotics I've got stashed away with other medical supplies. He's fine with that. The next part? Less so. Mother f-! He holds out the F as I splash the injury with rubbing alcohol. Is he okay? Sarah asks. She stands a few feet away from me, and I can see the concern in her eyes, not just for Mark's condition, but for the fact that someone she doesn't know is treating it. "He'll be fine," I say. "The antibiotics will do most of the work. He should be back to normal in a few days."
"But I've got a big game tomorrow, Coach,"
Mark says flatly.
"I'm confused," Sarah says.
She turns to Mark.
"You didn't know she was a woman? Or Lorik?"
"I just thought that since Gard was so good with computers..." Mark starts. She narrows her eyes a little.
"What?"
Mark asks. "Okay, yes, I just assumed she was a dude. My bad. I guess Gard is technically gender neutral."
"You're from Lorien."
Sarah says this more than asks. I nod.
"And being older, you must have been there when the planet was attacked."
I nod again, slower this time. Sarah's face seems to soften. "I was on a different ship than the Chosen Guard," I say. "There were only a few of us."
"Ella," she murmurs,
and the name stops my heart. "What do you know about her?" I ask, taking two long steps until I'm towering over Sarah. "Have you met her? Is she with Number 4? She shakes her head.
"The Moogs took her,"
she says slowly. I swallow hard. "And Creighton? Did they take him too?"
"Creighton,"
Sarah whispers. It takes a few seconds for her to place the name.
"No, I'm sorry. He was killed a while ago. In Spain, right before Ella joined the others."
The shock of all this must register on my face, because suddenly Sarah isn't looking at me like she's afraid I'm going to pull a blaster on her. Instead, she's got a hand on my back and a chair under me before I even realize that I'm sitting down.
"Of course," she says. "I should have realized you didn't know. You were on the other ship with them. Oh, God, I'm sorry."
My hands shake. I wonder how Creighton died. Protecting Ella, no doubt. Where could she be now? What might they be doing to her? My hands shake as I try to figure out what to do next. The chimera they call Bernie Kosar rubs against my legs in the form of a dog, staring up at me with a long tongue hanging out. His tail drums against the floor.
"I think he likes you," Sarah says.
I crouch down, looking into his dark eyes. "I knew many of your kind once," I say, thinking back to those days that seemed so long ago, when Zophie and Creighton and tiny baby Ella and I were all cooped up in our ship with a dozen chimerae. "I hope to see more of you again one day." He lets out a little whine and licks a salty tear from the side of my face.
If it's any consolation," Mark says, "it sounds like Ella turned out to be a total badass. Like, apparently she was at Dulcie and caused some damage."
"She was at Dulcie? When? How close was I to her?" I wipe my cheek with my sleeve and look over at Mark. He's shifting on his feet, his forehead wrinkled with concern. I think he's trying to make me feel better. "Yeah, so, anyway," he continues, nodding to the back of the hangar. "Maybe you could show us the inside of this thing? I've never been in a spaceship before." I smile a little. "Keep your eyes open, Jolly Roger, and maybe you'll fly it one day." Chapter 11.
"Holy shit!"
Mark says as we step up the metal ramp and into the ship.
"I mean, holy shit!"
"Wait until you see her at top speed," I say, "if I can get her to run on Earth fuels."
"Fingers crossed," Sarah murmurs. Her eyes are wide as she looks around.
Superstition won't get this beauty up and running. I was just putting the finishing touches on the new fuel line when you two arrived. Let's see if I was successful.
You mean we're going to take off right now?
Mark asks. No. I'm just going to start up the engines with any luck. He looks a little nervous.
I tap on the instrument panels when we get to the cockpit. They slowly flicker on. The ship hums to life around us.
That seems like a good sign, Sarah says.
Here comes the real test, I say.
I touch a few more of the controls. The ship slowly begins to lift off the ground. Beside me, Mark clutches the back of one of the mounted chairs in front of the controls and whispers a dozen curses. We're a few feet off the floor and hovering inside the hangar when the entire craft starts to shake, then suddenly drops a few inches, causing my two human companions to cry out in alarm. But the ship recovers. It levels itself off until all systems look normal.
By Lorien, I murmur.
I think it's going to work.
The ship's running off the fuel line I've installed. Plus, we have a few days of backup from the charged crystals.
That's good? Sarah asks.
It's very good, I say.
I set the ship back down and power off. Mark looks a little shaky on his feet. There's a sheen of sweat on his forehead.
I think I should probably sit down, he says.
Sarah touches his forehead.
His fever's breaking.
I take them back down and into what used to be the foreman's office when the hangar was still a processing plant. Now it's filled with computer equipment and monitors. We start to trade information. We learn about each other. I give Mark and Sarah an abbreviated rundown of my history, leaving out the parts about me using Mark or tracking all of his communications. Though, by the look on his face, I'm guessing he's figured that out by now. Sarah gets me up to date on the latest with the Guard, who they are and what legacies they've manifested. She tells me everything she knows about the Moogs. It's easier to get information now that I don't have to use Mark as the middleman between us or avoid talking about my identity. I learn that not only has Malcolm Good been found, but his son, Sam, has joined the fight. I can't help but smile at this, to know that Malcolm has been reunited with that little boy from outside his office. I can't say that they're safe in the middle of all this, but at least they're together. I ask a lot of questions about the girl Ella has become, and find out that she is a strong, sensitive young guard, just the kind of person I imagine Creighton would have wanted her to be. Sarah has spent a significant amount of time with her, and I can tell that she's worried about Ella as she speaks, that she cares for her.
Everything happened so fast in Chicago, Sarah says, her eyes looking off into the middle distance. Ella was having some kind of vision, and then suddenly the Moogs were there. We were overpowered.
Mogadorian scum, I mutter.
We'll get her back.
Mark grins a little.
And we'll waste a bunch of those pale freaks along the way. Ashes to ashes. Dust to...
Really, Mark? Sarah asks.
What?
His eyebrows draw together for a second. Then he relaxes a little.
You're right. I should have saved that for after we'd kill What's-His-Raw or something.
Sarah doesn't say anything, just smirks a little and rolls her eyes. She turns to one of the monitors at her side, one that's tuned to a 24-hour news station. Her eyes get wide, and several small sounds come from her mouth, but no actual words form.
Oh, come on, Mark says quietly, concerned.
It wasn't that bad, Sarah.
Oh, God, she manages.
Several of my computers start beeping, telling me that something important has happened, that news is breaking.
Sarah, what is it?
Mark is by her side in a few swift steps, and then he too is unable to form words.
It's only when I join them that I realize what's wrong. A giant Mogadorian warship is hovering over New York City.
It's happening, I murmur. The invasion has begun.
It's not just New York. The ships are everywhere, over cities across the planet. We watch the news in shocked silence until Sarah's satellite phone rings, and we all move at once. As Sarah speaks to number 4, I spring into action, opening my laptop. Reporters are starting to talk about some sort of conference at the UN, something that's been alluded to in MogPro documents I'd uncovered on Purdy's computer, but never really understood. This invasion is so much different from Lorien's. There is no fire or missiles, at least, not yet. I think they're going to pretend to be diplomatic about this, I say. That would explain why they've cozied up to the government so much, Mark agrees. He pulls a laptop out of his bag, the one I gave him back before he tried to get into Dulcie, and starts typing. Get me everything damning you have about the U.S. and the Moogs that you haven't sent me. If the Moogs are going public, so are we. It's time to tell this planet everything we know. I want this info on the front page of every website, every way ahead of you, he says with a grin. I'm sending you a zip file that includes the worst of MogPro and a collection of the most relevant posts I did for They Walk Among Us. Some I haven't even proofed or uploaded yet. The files show up on my screen. They're perfect and complement the info bomb I've been putting together myself for the last few years. This is great, Mark. I nod to him. He shrugs. I'm not letting these dickwads try to pull a fast one on the human race.
It sounds like the others are on the same wavelength, Sarah says, hanging up from her call. Sam just sent us some video. Footage of John using his powers to heal someone and some clips of Moogs shooting. I was thinking we could make a video or something to explain what's happening.
That's good, Mark says. We could link all this MogPro info from it. Guard, I mean, Lexa, could you, I don't know, push a video to the front page of YouTube or something?
Easily, I say. You two focus on getting that ready. I'm going to take care of a few last-minute adjustments to this ship and make sure she's ready for travel. And fully stocked. I've accumulated an arsenal of weapons here.
Mark bangs his fist against the desk he set his laptop on.
Damn it, he says. I was going to use that video of John going all Superman and jumping out of my burning house, but I can't find it.
Of course not, I say, tapping on my computer. I scrubbed that video from the internet as soon as it came to my attention. I also managed to crash the cell phone it came from. Here, I just sent you a copy I saved from my records, along with some other images and footage I've collected over the years. As I start to walk away, I hear Sarah whisper to Mark.
She's good.
You don't know the half of it, he says back.
I start a final inspection on the new fuel line for the ship, trying to cram days of work into a few hours. I pause only when Sarah starts shouting, and I watch on television as fighting breaks out at the United Nations. Number 4 is there, looking powerful and unwavering as he faces Cetricus Ra, the leader of the Mogadorians. Sarah is pale as she watches, but doesn't say anything. When the TV feed cuts out, she just nods.
I'm ready to record the voiceover.
They get back to work. So do I. Hours pass, and when I finally take a break for water and an energy bar, I find Mark and Sarah still huddled around Mark's laptop.
Hey, Mark says, come look at this.
He and Sarah scoot apart as they bring up a video to full screen and hit play.
This is our planet, but we are not alone in the galaxy.
Sarah's voice comes through the speakers, cool and measured, as the video zooms out on a picture of the Earth. The footage switches to the YouTube clip of number 4,
and then to him hovering his glowing hands over someone I hardly recognize as the Secretary of Defense. John appears to be healing him. Sarah continues. There are aliens among us. Good aliens. Refugees from the planet Lorien. This is John Smith, one of the Lorik Guard, a boy blessed with incredible powers. He fights for Earth now. It's his home. The video switches to clips of Mogadorians with blasters, herding humans around what look like the streets of New York. The ships above our cities now are not friendly. They are the Mogadorians, the bad aliens who destroyed John Smith's home world. They have come here to enslave us and to take Earth for their own. They have even found allies in our own government. Various documents and bits of text pop up on the screen. I recognize them as Moog profiles. The footage suddenly switches to a graphic showing the locations of the Moog warships. It looks like a screen grab Mark took from one of the news stations. Sarah concludes, "We are not alone. They walk among us. We must join forces with the Lorik and fight the Mogadorians." The video ends. So, if they click anywhere on the video, it takes them to the website and to all the files we've put together, Mark says. And there'll be a link in the description, obviously. Do you think it's okay? It's the best we can do on short notice, Sarah says. She bites her lip as she stares at the screen. It's great, I say. Upload it to They Walk Among Us in case the video gets pulled. When it's uploaded, I manipulate a few lines of code and algorithms so that the video is at the top of every internet search and all over the front page of YouTube. The number of views skyrocket over the course of a few minutes, faster than the counters can keep up with. Even with everything that's happening across the planet, the video spreads. Mark says it's gone viral. In a world suddenly full of questions, we, for once, are able to offer some answers. Before long, it's being shown on news stations across the globe. I may have had doubts about many things on this planet, but the way information spreads here has proven to be more impressive than I could ever have imagined. Mark continues tapping on his computer, while Sarah tries futilely to get number 4 on her satellite phone. She never takes her eyes off of the news. Night falls. I go back to working on the ship. Ideally, I'd have some time to take it out for a few tests before storming into battle. But I don't have that luxury now. Not with warships parked over cities across the globe. Still, I take the time to triple-check my work and run every diagnostic test I can think of. The last thing we need is a systems failure in the middle of a fight with the Moogs. It's light outside when I'm finally satisfied with my work and come back out into the hangar. Mark is slumped over the desk, mouth open as he sleeps, snoring softly. Sarah gives me a weak smile.
He passed out while refreshing the view counts. I figured he could use the rest.
She stares at the phone in her hands, and it's obvious she still hasn't been able to get in contact with number 4. From what I've seen of him, John is quite the impressive guard. I'm sure he's still fighting. Sarah nods a little.
Yeah, of course he is.
She gets quiet, and it feels as though the energy has been sucked out of the room. After being alone for so long, I am perhaps not the best at small talk, and so I grab a couple of bottles of water from a mini fridge and slam one down next to Mark's head. He jumps, springing to life.
What? Where?
His eyes dart around, and his breathing quickens until he remembers where he is.
Oh, right. What did I miss?
Sarah's phone starts ringing before either of us can answer.
It's him!
She half shouts as she jumps to her feet.
He'll know what's going on in New York.
Right on cue, Mark says through a yawn. Our E.T. savior.
Sarah answers on the third ring. Her face is bright, hopeful despite everything going wrong across the planet.
John?
She asks, breathless. And the few seconds before the voice on the other end of the line responds are an eternity.
All right.
Mark rolls his chair over to me. He stretches his arms over his head and cracks his neck.
What now?
I've waited years for this fight to arrive. I point to the ship. I say we join the rest of the guard and show the Mogadorians what this old girl can do. There's no use hiding in the shadows anymore.
Hell yeah! Let's kick some Mog ass!
It's time we take the fight to them. I turn to Mark. I can't help but smile a little. I want to see if Ella remembers me when we free her.
We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of I Am Number 4, The Lost Files, Rebel Allies, by Pittacus Lore. Performed by Jonathan McLean and Cherise Booth. This program was produced by Dion Audio Services. Executive Producer, Caitlin Gehring. Text copyright 2015 by Pittacus Lore. Production copyright 2015 by HarperCollins Publishers. All rights reserved. Thank you for listening.